dresses and going to the hairdresser once a week for her wash and set. At the same age, I'm out in a leather miniskirt dancing the night away at a local club with my favorite drag queens after handing out birth control to my kids so they don't make me a grandma anytime soon. I'm not claiming to be old, and generally speaking, society doesn't see me as old. But there are things to keep in mind as you age in order to maintain a body that enjoys sexual intimacy. The biggest change is within our hormone levels. Testosterone and estrogen levels generally drop in cis men and cis women, respectively, as we get older. For cis men, this can mean erectile dysfunction or even just full arousal being more difficult to gain and maintain. Read, a chubby instead of a stiffy. And when you do get the blood flowing, completing to orgasm doesn't always happen. Thanks, Wang. For cis women, the reduction in estrogen can lead to vaginal dryness, as well as emotional changes and body changes that cause levels of stress that decrease sexual desire. There isn't a ton of research for non-cis folks on how their hormone therapy is affected by aging, but it is definitely something to take into consideration and chat with your doc about. There are both prescription medications and complementary treatments, herb supplements, acupuncture, etc., that can help mitigate these hormonal drops. But once we start aging, the likelihood of other conditions popping up is much higher as well. Disabilities and chronic disease. When we talk about all the ways someone can achieve a minority status in the world, disability is the category that any of us can end up in any time. Whether you have a disability that you have lived with your whole life, or you entered this category due to a later accident and illness, it requires a huge adjustment. Some of the stuff that may come up can include body image issues. Your body may look and work differently than it has in the past, or how the other people around you look and function. Anxiety of things not being the same as they were before, or the same as what partners are used to from other relationships. Anger at having a disability or chronic disease. Feelings of guilt, as if the disease or disability is punishment for past actions. Worries about partner's unhappiness and dissatisfaction. Worried about partner being unfaithful or leaving you. Frustrations that desire doesn't match current access or ability. Anger that your partner is healthy, but you aren't. Possible issues for partners can include being frustrated with the limitations put upon your sex life because of the disability. Feeling deprived and angry about it, and then maybe guilty for being angry. Resenting being in a caretaker role for their partner. Guilty that they are not sick. Challenged by their partner's changing body. Struggling with physical attraction. Worried about hurting them, etc. Of course, these kinds of feelings can come up for the other reasons we discussed previously, but they are generally most prevalent when individuals are dealing with a chronic condition that seriously impacts their physical health and ability to express themselves sexually. Mental and physical health issues. You might be thinking, Doc, I'm not in a wheelchair and I'm not 97 years old. This whole section doesn't apply to me. But hey, we are all living in an increasingly toxic world, so issues around sexual functioning are so damn commonplace for everyone it merits discussion. Mental and physical health diagnoses that do not directly affect sexual functioning can still affect sexual functioning. Meaning, sexual functioning can easily be a secondary issue because of something else you are living with. For example, over 100 million people in the United States have a diagnosis of diabetes. Research shows that 50% of the men and 35% of women who have diabetes experience sexual dysfunction because of it. The good news is that if their diabetes is well controlled, those numbers drop quite a bit. The bad news is literally millions of people are struggling with sexual dysfunction because they have diabetes, and we aren't talking about it. Cancer treatment, high blood pressure, heart disease, and just good old common stress can all impact our interest in and or our ability to engage in the types of sex we want to engage in. And lest we forget, mental health issues also have a huge impact on the physical body. We talked about PTSD in an earlier chapter, but all mental health issues impact our sense of self and our place in the world, and that will absolutely impact how we connect to others. For example, if you are experiencing a depressive episode so bad you haven't had a shower in 3 days, the chances of you being interested in sex is also probably about nil. Long-term medication use for health issues can also affect sexual functioning. This is by far not an exhaustive list, but just to give you an idea, hormones can cause desire disorders. Antihypertensive medications, blood pressure medications, can cause arousal disorders. Many antidepressants and some mood stabilizers can cause desire and arousal disorders. Even just plain old over-the-counter decongestants and antihistamines can cause arousal and ejaculation disorders. Childbirth. Later in the book, I discuss managing a fulfilling sex life if you have kiddos wandering around your house. That shit ain't easy. And the giving birth to them part of the program adds another layer to the conversation. The general media portrayal is that it's a mystical experience from which your body bounces back immediately. Praise be people like Chrissy Teigen who are honest and forthright about what their bodies are like after having kids. Chrissy, call me. We are totally besties in my mind. Even if you had the most glorious pregnancy ever, with no morning sickness and stretch marks and cramps and shit, even if you had the easiest birth experience ever, with no C-sections or episiotomies or tears or hemorrhoids, hey, kid number two, if you are reading this, you owe me. And your body bounced right back? Childbirth changes us. It changes our relationship with our bodies because it was used to grow another human. So many people have told me that their body simply didn't feel like theirs anymore, and it was a disconcerting realization. And if you are breast or chest feeding, the whole sustaining a small, dependent living being thing lives on. With chapped nipples, leaks, clogged ducts, and all that other fun stuff. And hey, even if you aren't breast or chest feeding, you still have a tiny, fully dependent, and wildly fragile human attached to you on a regular basis. Maybe on the outside and not the inside anymore, but they are a ways away from being mobile instead of portable, right? So what do we do? Everyone's experience is really unique, so I can't hook you up with a specific plan to have the best sex possible while dealing with something chronic and debilitating. But I can help you look at some good general solutions, give you a list of questions to bring to your doctor's office, and then give you a few more to think about and talk to your partner about while you do this work. The medical journal American Family Physician published a piece on sexual functioning and chronic illness back in 2003 that had some pragmatic general advice about optimizing sexual functioning as much as possible for individuals with chronic issues. Here's the breakdown of what the authors of that article suggest, along with a few ideas that I've used successfully in my practice. Dietary interventions. No tobacco. No matter how you are getting it in your body. No smoking, vaping, chewing, etc. Limited alcohol intake, if you can use alcohol at all with your diagnosis and medication regime. Wait 2 hours after eating or drinking alcohol before engaging in sexual activity. Eat as cleanly as possible. The less additives and toxins, the better you feel in general. Is the food you're eating a product of the Industrial Revolution, or is it something our ancestors would recognize? Cleaning up your diet isn't easy, and it is expensive. I totally get that. But whatever small changes you can afford to make may have a huge impact on your well-being. Consider whole food supplements to help you get the nutrients you were missing out on. For example, soil depletion means we have far less trace minerals in our fruits and vegetables than we did 100 years ago. I take, and have everyone in my family on some form of a mineral supplement. Talk to your doctor about what types of exercise you can tolerate physically. Match that list against your list of exercise you can tolerate emotionally. Gentle movement that actually feels good to you can be incredibly beneficial in building strength and flexibility, or at least slowing the loss of strength and flexibility of the course of your illness. Medication interventions. If you have chronic pain, take your pain medications 30 minutes before starting sexual activity. Talk to your prescriber about which of your medications may have sexual side effects and discuss reducing or stopping those medications and replacing them with something you tolerate better or finding ways to manage those side effects. For example, many antidepressants can cause sexual side effects. Say you're on Zoloft and it's working brilliantly, but you are noticing that your depression is far more manageable. Your doctor may choose to add Wellbutrin rather than simply take you off one and put you on the other. That way, you keep the med in your system that is working and sidestep the sexual side effects with the added med. If your diagnosis has caused an onset of depression, which is entirely probable and makes a ton of sense, make sure you get that depression treated. Environmental interventions. Keep your home at a comfortable temperature. If you need it warmer to help your pain, do that. If you need it cooler to help your breathing, do that too. Plan sexual activity for the times you know you have gotten the most rest and your energy levels are good. This may be time of day, time of week, or time of month. For example, many people on chemotherapy get breaks in the cycles and know their energy levels are the best near the end of the break. Plan sexual activity for times when energy level is highest and when rested, or for a time of day when symptoms tend to be least bothersome. Be flexible with types of sex. Going back to the five myths that need to die in a fire, specifically that certain types of sex are inferior to others, as well as bodily positions, use pillows, wedges, or other supports if they help. Consider using sexual aids, sex toys, to augment your experience, and see the mission for more info. Emotional interventions. Communicate openly and honestly about needs, wants, likes, and dislikes with partners. See part 3 of this book for more information on communication strategies. Explore your own body through solo sex. It's easier to communicate what works for you to someone else if you've already figured it out for yourself. Plus, regular orgasms may help you feel better physically and emotionally. Use intimate touching that isn't designed to lead directly to sex every time. See your mission on Sensate Focus exercises. Focus on all of your senses and the parts of your body where you enjoy sensation the most, even if they aren't traditional erogenous zones. A friend of mine sustained a nasty spinal injury. He recovered fully, except afterwards he realized that he had more sensation above the point of injury rather than below. His neck being stroked was the best way to encourage his arousal. Things to ask your doc. A friend of mine is going through a chemo treatment that has caused a lot of damage to her hands. Cracking, pain, numbness, etc. She has to be really careful of them right now. Her doctor came through the chemo room to check on her, then grabbed a handful of the medical gloves from the nurse's station and shoved them into my friend's purse. She said, "You know, you might want to be able to touch someone this weekend, and you should." It's an awkward way to start the discussion, but also very thoughtful and sweet. In a perfect world, your doctors would be the ones opening up this conversation, saying something like, "It's pretty common for people with this condition to notice that it's affected their sex lives in some way. Have you noticed anything we need to address?" This opens the door for you to bring up any questions you have. However, a lot of docs may not open the conversation in this regard. A lot of doctors are uncomfortable bringing up the topic of sex, even if they are comfortable discussing it. For example, many docs will tell you that Kegel exercises can help you better control your PC muscles, which can help with bladder control, premature ejaculation, pain associated with penetration, etc. Instructions on Kegels, by the way, are included in this book. But they'll only talk about this if you bring it up. You'd think it would be incumbent upon them to ask, but a lot of them won't. So you may have to be the person to say you have questions. And if they can't answer the questions, tell them to refer you to someone who can. A huge number of my clients are referred from other treating professionals. They only need to come in for a session or two to get some good information to help them navigate what they are going through. Not sure what to ask? Here's some questions to start with. Are certain kinds of sexual activity off limits? Which ones? What is the safest kind of activity for me right now? What should I do if I have pain or medical issues during activity? Will my meds affect my sex life? Or libido, or desire, or ability to perform? If so, do I have other medication options? Other ways of managing these effects? Are there any circumstances under which I should avoid sexual activity? Will I ever be able to fill in the blank again? What's the best case, worst case, and most likely scenario? If regaining the ability to engage in some sexual activity that I can't do now is possible, what would help me be able to do that? Are there any resources that are specific to my situation that you recommend? Are there any other treatment professionals you recommend me working with that may help with this issue? And finally, some questions just for your own reflection. When it comes down to it, there may be some self-reflection and partner communication that can help far more than any other doctor or sex therapist. Here are some things to think and talk about. What was the quality of the sexual relationship before the illness or injury? Sometimes, if things were already not going well, this issue becomes the excuse to just stop trying altogether. What makes something sex? Has that changed? Could it change to encompass more activities than you've done in the past? Where do you feel sensation and pleasure? What do you miss most? What does your partner state that they miss most? What things are working well? What do you most want to communicate to your partner? What are your fears in doing so? Conclusion for part one. It's no secret that I think all of our emotional work should start with figuring out what created the problem to begin with. I know that in my own life, understanding how I got somewhere is an essential part of me getting back out of it again. I'm guessing you are also one of those people. I mean, you're listening to this right now, when you could be doing so many other things with your time, right? This serves two purposes. One is to become aware of pitfalls that lead it to becoming a problem again. Like, if you realize you and your partner grew up in households with fucked up communication patterns, and that's killing your relationship, you know you are going to have to do the work to reconnect and continue to be aware of using better communication patterns so you aren't back down in that hole. But also, and I heard this over and over and over again from people who read my book, Unfuck Your Brain, it's so helpful to know you aren't just fucking crazy, or fundamentally broken, or any of those things we tend to tell ourselves and have other messages telling us. Relationships get fucked up because they are hard. Intimacy isn't easy shit to navigate. And everything we have ever been through, and that our partners has been through, has been added to the mix. And there is often a bunch of shit that has to be looked at and dealt with so we can get to the good stuff. So let's start looking and dealing. Part 2. Unfuck your relationship with yourself. If you are listening to this right now, that means you are a grown-ass human who understands that the only person you have any real power over is yourself. Sucks, doesn't it? But that's why we are starting here. After we get a better handle on where everything came from, the best place to get to work is with the person we know the best, have known the longest, and are gonna be stuck with forever. which is to say, our own damn selves. When we do our own work, understand our own responses, and stay truly connected to our own bodies, we are far better able to connect with others, or truly understand why we can't. Self-compassion. I've written about self-compassion a lot. So if you have read my other stuff, you may be over it already. But I think it's one of those topics that can't be oversaid, so I'm going to keep at it. I think of self-compassion as a gift of desperation, meaning it's something that we come to when we are desperate enough to stop trying to do things the way we've always done them and try something completely different. The term self-esteem is one I hear every day. Of course, I work in mental health, so it's to be expected, but you probably hear this word all the damn time too, no matter what you do for a living. It's like a cultural touchstone of success. If your self-esteem is good, you're winning at life. And that's not a bad thing, right? The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines self-esteem as a confidence and satisfaction in oneself. It is considered one of those universally good qualities for human beings to achieve. We want to have good self-esteem for sure. Who wouldn't want to feel confident and satisfied with themselves? And we want the people we love to share that feeling. But when I have been asked to run self-esteem groups, I always say no. Because when you really look at the definition of self-esteem and look at how we use it to define ourselves in this society, you see that self-esteem is dependent upon circumstances. If you succeed to a level of your expectations, you feel good about yourself. If you fall short, it is crushing. Self-esteem is determined in comparison to the success or failure of those around us, which leads us to become more competitive and less accepting and fluctuates constantly based on what is happening around us. Self-compassion, on the other hand, is a mindful awareness of your value and worth as a human being. A human being who is flawed, imperfect, and struggling. Self-esteem is the antithesis of self-compassion. Self-compassion is inclusive instead of competitive and is always available to us, even when we are not our best selves or successful by the standards we have established. Self-compassion was a huge struggle for me when I first came upon it in my mid-30s, but it was truly a gift of desperation at that time in my life. Beating myself up wasn't working. Willing my self-esteem to be different than it was didn't work either. And finally, I was desperate enough and exhausted enough to just try loving myself instead. And my whole fucking world changed. Self-compassion is no different from the compassion we give others. If our dearest family members or friends are struggling, we are kind and supportive instead of critical and shaming. Except we have a hard time giving this same kind of care to ourselves. Why are we hardest on ourselves? We are raised with the socio-cultural message that we are responsible for our actions. That's not a bad thing. And, I'd say, an empirical truth to a certain extent. However, tied to that idea is that you should never let yourself off the hook for failings and bad behavior. And because we all fail frequently, repeatedly, and epically, because we are imperfect, we are always bashing ourselves against the metaphorical rocks. That voice inside your head? The one that tells you that you must be perfect? That voice is setting you up for failure. However, self-compassion is not letting oneself off the hook, as some people think. Self-compassion means we give ourselves the support, encouragement, and tough love that we give our dearest friends and family. It does not mean we lower our standards, throw huge pity parties for ourselves, or indulge in continuous bad behavior. It is the mediating voice between self-criticism and self-complacency. As human beings, we are flawed and fault-filled. We also have the ability to accomplish amazing things and have deep, fulfilling relationships. When we view ourselves with compassion, we see the truest picture of both our flaws and our capacity for transcendence. And when we value ourselves for our efforts, we learn to confront, forgive, and transform our shortcomings. Intimacy work can be fun. but it is quite often difficult work that requires confronting issues and having conversations that we are not used to having. Our ability to face many of the issues that cause barriers to intimacy requires a great deal of self-compassion. It is the currency we need for change. One of the truest forms of emotional intelligence, it means we are both mindful of and engaged with our thoughts and feelings. Life in general requires a great deal of self-compassion. Because I have written about self-compassion a ton in the past, including a bunch of general self-compassion exercises, I won't keep yammering on in this regard. If you are digging on the idea, I have a zine just on self-compassion, and it also pops up in my coping skills book. But self-compassion is something I hope you will explore holding for yourself throughout this unfuckinging process. Intimacy is so very raw and reaches into all the core components of who we are individually and in connection. This process is replete with opportunities to practice self-compassion. And honestly, will probably be the thing that helps you through it. A lot of times, we have stuff in our history that affects our current life and relationships. A lot of times, we aren't even very aware of what that stuff is and where it comes from. A past history of everything you've learned about sex and the kinds of sex you have engaged in, official term, a sexual history, is something that many medical or therapeutic professionals may do with you if you are experiencing challenges in your sexual relationships. And originally, this book was going to include a pretty intensive sexual history questionnaire. There was only one problem with that. It's a pretty intensive questionnaire. Completing such a form on your own has the potential of being just too much. So instead, there are some questions for reflection scattered throughout this book. But even scaled down, these might be anxiety-provoking. You do not have to answer anything that you are not comfortable exploring. You are not graded on assignment completion here. It's fine. However, consider that any questions that trigger a strong emotional response may be tied to any current issues that you are exploring in your current intimate relationships. And if things are getting stirred up, consider investing in your own self-care by working with someone who specializes in these issues. Questions to get you started. 1. What was your purpose in buying this book? What was the one thing, or the main thing, or the biggest thing, you were hoping to get out of reading it? 2. What negative experiences have you had regarding sex and intimacy? You don't have to write out a whole trauma narrative, maybe just a word or phrase. For example, the attack or the abusive partner as an identifier. It can be a good way to honor an experience without digging up everything about that experience in an untethered way. 3. What messages have you received about sex in the past? Positive, negative, or neutral? Many people didn't receive negative messages per se, but it was simply omitted from conversations in your household growing up. Was sex discussed at all? 4. How was sex presented in the media you were exposed to? What kinds of stuff did you discuss with your friends and other peers? With people you had romantic relationships with? 5. If you could tell your younger self one thing about all these messages, what would it be? Boundaries. I mean, obs. Boundaries aren't just about intimate relationships. Boundaries all over the damn place would make the world far more tenable. Could you just imagine how different the world would be if we taught children about boundaries at this age? To consider the space of others before they engaged? To figure out which space is important to themselves? I realize that some people are just total dicks no matter what. But I've worked in mental health my entire career, and I think the number of people out there that were fundamentally, irrevocably born broken is really very small. Most of us are just ill-trained and ill-prepared for this epic shitstorm we call life. And this is what shines through in the day-to-day dickitude of human interaction. And it becomes the most obvious in the relationships that we value the most and with the people we are supposed to be closest to. You know, in our intimate interactions. Boundaries should be the foundation of these relationships. Instead, they are rarely addressed at all. And this is super problematic because boundary setting is not always overt and action-oriented. One of the biggest problems of modern culture is that they haven't been. Instead, boundaries are more often defined by a lack of words or action. Not talking about things sends the message that these things aren't worth talking about, that they don't matter, that what we want and need and desire doesn't matter, about who we are in relation to others doesn't matter, and that seeps into all our other interactions. A study conducted by researchers at the University of North Dakota found that 1 out of 3 college men stated that they would rape a woman if they knew they could get away with it, if you took the ugly word rape out of the question. When the term was intentions to rape a woman, 13.6% agreed that they would do so. But when the term was intentions to force a woman to sexual intercourse, the number jumped to 31.7%. 1 in 3. Are 1 in 3 cis straight men actually born with a predilection to sexual violence toward women? Really, honestly? Some of you may have had experiences that lead you to believe this is the case, but I honestly don't think so. I think we have fucked up our obligation as members of a larger society to teach what boundaries really are. We've boundaried the word rape, but clearly not the act. The majority of people in my private practice are straight cis men, and I have found them to be kind, loving, and actively seeking true partnership and connection with the women they love. Even when they come in blustery and angry, it doesn't take long to find the underlying hurt they are trying to shield from further damage. They may be the cultural winners in terms of privilege, but trust someone working within the quiet depths of emotional terrain, they are supremely fucked up and fucked over, too. We continue to disservice everyone, not just those individuals with less privilege, by not teaching people the art of boundaries. So where do we start? Boundaries are inherently unique. There is no one-size-fits-all way of creating healthy boundaries for ourselves in relation to others. Maybe that's why the school system doesn't even try. But we can create a framework for discussion. We can look at ourselves and start conversations in our relationships that we haven't had before. And this reflexivity and those conversations have the power to create huge shifts, not just in our lives, but within the rest of the world. What are your boundaries? So often as a therapist, I ask people questions that no one else has ever asked them, questions they haven't asked themselves. Understanding them is the first step in communicating them, after all. Here are 2 boundary-establishing questions to consider for yourself. This is where we listen to and within ourselves and pay attention to the answers we find. Because this book is focused on intimacy, think about yourself in relationship to an intimate partner. But you will notice that these questions are open enough to apply to all kinds of relationships. 1. What's the deal breaker? What is the absolute no-fly zone in this situation? When do you know you are done with this, whatever this situation is, for good? 2. Gut check time. When I ask you about this situation, what is your strong emotional reaction to what I am asking? Not what you think you should say, not what you know the intellectual answer to be, but what your body tells you the answer actually is. How do you communicate your boundaries? Take out the blame and shame of how you should communicate your boundaries, because seriously, you are not a shitty and defective human being if you've struggled with this stuff. Our larger culture does not value either boundaries or authentic communication, so most of us struggle with this, not just in communicating our boundaries, but in all our communication. So this is our starting point. Let's talk about communication styles for a sec. There are 3 main communication styles. Aggressive communication styles tend to be excessively harsh. Aggressive communicators tend to interrupt others, disregard their opinion, and continually reinforce their worldview and the rightness of it. Have you ever met anyone like this? Seen a politician on TV act like this? You know the type. You say you like pineapple on pizza, and they roll their eyes and tell you that's gross, you're gross, and that is empirically wrong, and you need to stop. The meta message of aggressive communicators is, I'm okay, you're a dumbass. Assertive communication style is our sweet spot in most cases, unless your literal safety is on the line and being situationally aggressive makes sense. Assertive communicators are firm in their belief systems and speak in a way that is congruent with their actions, but they do so in a way that still respects differing viewpoints of others. If you say you want pineapple on your pizza, they may respond with, "Glad to see you out there living your best life. I've heard y'all pineapple pizza folks exist. Pineapple on your half of the pie it is. Get pineapple juice on my half, though, and I may have to cut you." The meta message of assertive communicators is, I'm okay, you're totally okay too, even if we don't agree. Passive communication style tends to be ineffective in helping people protect themselves and hold their center. Passive communicators often don't make their wants and needs known and say that things are fine when they are really, totally, deeply not fine. Passive communicators tend to defer to others, praising them while dumping on themselves. This isn't the same thing as letting someone you know and trust help guide you to better decision-making in a crisis. This is never feeling like you can authentically advocate for what is right for you. Passive communicators, back to the pizza example I apparently cannot let go of, might say, "Oh, pineapple. That would definitely be the better choice. I don't need mushrooms. Mushrooms are probably wrong. Let's do the pineapple. I can always just use hydrocortisone for the rash that pineapple gives me later. Yeah, I'm allergic, but not really bad. It's totally okay." The meta message of passive communicators is, I'm a hot mess, but you're totally okay, so you make the decisions for both of us. If our boundaries are the essential building blocks of our relationships, then how we communicate these boundaries is critical. What is your general communication style most of the time? Is that different in different circumstances or with different people? What messages have you internalized about your right to healthy communication and ownership of your values and beliefs? If there are differences in certain situations or with certain people, what about those relationships cause your change? How close is your current communication style to what your ideal balance would be? What is the first place you can start to shift your communication style, moving closer to your ideal? How will you go about doing that? Understanding how we communicate is the first step in actually communicating. Generally speaking, we aren't taught how to do so, so we have to figure that part out first. If you don't communicate as well as you would like to, owning that as part of your conversation is really important, as in, "Hey, partner person, I realized recently that I don't communicate things that are important to me nearly as well as I should. Then I end up butthurt because you didn't understand what I was trying to say, and you end up confused as fuck, which is understandable. I'm working on that. So what I've been trying to say, albeit not well, is..." And if you have this conversation with your partner person, I'm totally awarding you a gold star for badass adulting. Effective communication is a relationship hobgoblin, and I talk more about communication strategies in part 3 of this book, which may help the process. The biggest thing to remember here is that it is a process. You may need to ask each other questions and keep figuring things out. You may have to clarify what you mean until it comes out right. Your partner may resist the entire conversation, which means you have an entirely different issue. This ain't easy shit. Remember when I said boundaries are the foundation of an intimate relationship? That wasn't a throwaway metaphor. A few years ago, I had to have steel piers installed in the foundation of my house to keep the damn thing from breaking in half. The original foundation was bullshit, and it couldn't sustain over time. The work was expensive as fuck. Here's hoping it's finally paid off by the time this book is published. It was hugely disruptive to everyone's lives. You can still see the spots where the piers went in, and then they had to patch over the holes they dug. It was an enormous undertaking, but it was the only way to keep my house from splitting into two. How strict are your boundaries? We talk about maintaining our boundaries as if their adherence is a panacea for all that is wrong with the world. Some boundaries should be rigid, if they are defending real safety and security. Some boundaries in that regard are universal. Most are not. And honestly, being a rigid asshole is just as bad for us in the long run as letting someone stomp all over our boundaries on a daily basis. Boundaries that are rigid for me may not be at all an issue for someone else. We all have had different experiences and needs based on those experiences. That's part of the human condition. Our boundaries also change in different relationships, different circumstances, and different points in our lives. The issue is when so many boundaries become so rigid that they impede our own growth. Boundaries need to be rigid where our protection is of utmost importance. But otherwise, we need to have the capacity to negotiate while still maintaining our safety. The problem is, how do we maintain the capacity to negotiate without becoming a total pushover? That's that nebulous, hard-to-define difference between flexibility versus permeability. Permeability means that everything gets through if it wants to. The attacks come from the outside. Flexibility comes from the inside. It means you are the one willing to open the door or window, therefore moving the walls of that boundary around you. Generally speaking, are the majority of your boundaries rigid, flexible, or permeable? Which of your boundaries are rigid right now? Are there any that need to be challenged in that regard? Are there any that need to be more rigid? What messages have you internalized about your right to healthy boundaries and ownership of your individual boundary needs? Which of your boundaries are permeable right now? Are there any that need to be challenged and strengthened into being flexible or even rigid? Do you have any boundaries that should remain permeable? If so, how does that permeability support, sustain, or serve you at this point in your life? What would your ideal boundary balance look like? How close to this ideal are you right now? What is something that is actively in your total control that you can work on to move in the direction of your ideal? How do the people in your life respond to your boundaries? If you are struggling with the previous questions, this can be a really good perspective-getting section for you to work through. Because we're looking for patterns here, right? So this is a really important question. Which people in your life respect the boundaries that you effectively communicate? What do these people have in common? Which people do not? What do these people have in common? When giving a client a diagnosis, one of the things I look for is the impact across life domains. Unfancy way of saying that? I want to see if the issue presents itself in more than one area. For example, if the anxiety only presents at school, something is going on with school, asshole teacher, undetected learning disability, bullying, etc. If the anxiety also presents at home, when hanging out with friends, playing sports, etc., then the problem is anxiety. Makes sense, right? Same goes with this boundaries thing. If, generally speaking, most people in most situations don't respect your boundaries, then it's time to look back at how you were communicating your boundaries with them. Maybe you aren't communicating them as effectively as you thought. But if you are struggling more in specific relationships or with specific people who keep blowing past your boundaries, then you might, in fact, be dealing with an asshole or an asshole-infused specific life domain, like a really shitty office culture. Or beyond assholery, especially if this is a newer relationship, consider a few other possibilities. The possibility that this person has other stuff going on, such as other medical or emotional health issues, that make attending to what you are communicating really difficult for them. The possibility that this person is somewhere on the autism spectrum, however mild, making traditional conversational cues difficult for them to suss out. The possibility that this person might be an abuse groomer digging in their heels in an attempt to get you under emotional control. If the last scenario is the case, you know what you need to do. Seriously, get yourself safe. If the other scenarios are a possibility, time to have a different conversation with them. Ask them how they respond or learn best and try adapting your communication style to their learning style. For example, more concrete and pragmatic. You may be in a situation where you just have to suck it up to, I'm well aware. You have a shitty job you can't afford to leave, or you have a shitty family that you can't, at this time, extract yourself from. You have to weigh your options before you decide to throw down over a boundary. This is another place where the flexibility thing comes in. You will find tolerating a lack of respect of your boundaries far, far, far more easy to manage if you acknowledge that you are making a choice to maintain this relationship at this point in time rather than maintain the boundary. It may be the best choice for you at this moment. Reminding yourself that this is epic dickitude that is just slightly better than the alternative, so you are choosing to accept it for right now, can really help you tolerate how upset and angry you are feeling. It may also propel you into creating the action plan you need to extract yourself from an increasingly shitty situation, rather than sitting in that slime pool of disrespect and disregard forever. How do you respect other people's boundaries? Okay, so now that we got your boundary communication settled, that was a fuck ton of emotional work, wasn't it? Yeah. Let's go ahead and finish off the navel gazing by looking for a moment at how you respond to the boundaries of others. Generally speaking, do people tend to respond positively to you? Do they tell you they feel comfortable sharing with you? That you hear them without judgment? Do you have people, or at least one person in your life, with whom you are able to have a deep and authentic exchange of ideas and feelings? Are you able to maintain these relationships over a long period of time? What kinds of situations make it hard for you to respect the boundaries of others? Is it with certain people? Or when people are making certain decisions that cause you concern? The first three questions are a good self-examination of whether or not you are able to maintain relationships. If you struggle with the boundaries of others, it will start to eat away at your relationships in general. The fourth question is more universal, because I promise we all have situations in which we struggle with respecting other people's boundaries. For you, it might be with family members you care about, when people are making the same dumb decision for the 97th time, or when people engage in a behavior that you have seen lead to a bad end in yourself or in others. Those kinds of situations can really trigger a struggle to respect their boundaries. And it's okay to communicate that. To say something in the vein of, I'm having a hard time respecting your boundaries right now because I'm really worried about you. I don't want to try to start bossing you into doing what I want you to do. It might be better if we don't discuss this particular issue because I can't really be impartial. That's a nice way of saying, I don't agree with your decision, but I support your ability to make it for yourself. I may need to step away from the situation to maintain that support, but that's about me, not about you. It's also okay to ask for clarification of what kind of response are they hoping for. I struggle with the boundaries of my adult kiddos. Makes total sense, right? I still want to parent them. When they ask for my advice, I ask straight out, do you want the mom answer or the supportive adult in your life answer? This gives them the opportunity to let me know how flexible their boundaries are about my interference in this particular situation, and has probably saved us any number of fights over the years. I know. This is ridiculously difficult. This learning boundaries thing that no one ever taught you in the past. And you may find that people fight you hardcore on it when you start setting new limits. And that may mean making some difficult choices. Because when it comes down to it, we either let the world dictate to us what our boundaries are, or we communicate them out in the world with everything we do and say. As off-kilter as it can be at times, I would far rather lean into the discomfort of difficult conversations than let the world determine what is going to happen to me. It's one of the great ironies of the human condition that our intimate relationships, the ones that are the closest and most intense, are the ones where we are the most likely to run ragged over a partner's boundaries or let a partner bulldoze all over ours. Having some flexibility in our boundaries can help us challenge each other in relationship in new and beneficial ways. But it's also so easy to let them become so permeable that we end up hurt, angry, and resentful without being aware of how we got there. Boundaries are the everyday expression of consent. In the end, and more on consent in part 3. If boundaries are a relational foundation, and you realize that the foundation needs some work, putting in these support beams now may help prevent a catastrophe later. Exploring your sexual identity. At first, I didn't plan on writing about sexual orientation in this book. I wish, truly and deeply, that affirming discussion and quality information on this topic was part of our normal cultural discourse. You know, a real judgment-free zone. But it isn't. And while I have seen great progress in an acceptance of how truly diverse, fluid, and interesting sexual orientation is, I have also seen continuous pushback from others who want to erase identities that they don't understand or that are not neatly categorized. And those competing messages make it really difficult for many people to figure out who they really are. Since I haven't found a way to envelop everyone in a judgment-free zone bubble while they figure out who they are, I figured I could provide the best factual, evidence-based data about sexual identity I could find in order to support their process. I also need to add that this chapter is not going to be a treatise on why homosexuality is not a sin. If you are looking for good ammunition in that arena, my favorite book is Unclobber: Rethinking Our Misuse of the Bible on Homosexuality by Colby Martin. And as an aside, if you are looking for ammunition on why any form of sexuality other than heterosexuality is a sin, you picked up the wrong book, and you probably shouldn't listen to anything that I've ever written or will ever write, or anything published by Microcosm Publishing through the end of time. These won't be the droids you're looking for, I'm afraid. We're queer as fuck, y'all. There was a big kerfuffle in 2016 when the trend forecasting agency J. Walter Thompson Innovation Group put out the following survey results. Only 48% of Gen Zs, people born from 1995 to 2010, identify as exclusively heterosexual. Less than half. But it wasn't like suddenly we queered out in one generational shift. Their survey of people ages 21 to 34, the age range of millennials at the time of the survey, showed that only 65% considered themselves exclusively heterosexual. Not a majority, but still pretty damn queer. Why this shift? What's causing this? Environmental toxins? Impending Armageddon? The musical stylings of Miley Cyrus? Hillary Clinton's emails? Or maybe we've just always been this way. After all, fluid sexual orientation and gender identity existed without rancor before colonialism. Alfred Kinsey, toothbrush dude, yes, realized back in the 40s that sexuality exists on a continuum, hence the creation of his famous Kinsey scale. Just like the 450 other species I previously mentioned, this is just how we roll. There is literally nothing new here, except that we've opened up the discourse and are creating the language we need to support this discourse. Not only is our sexuality fluid, there is fluidity within our fluidity. So sexuality is fluid. It's also fluid across the lifespan, Where you land on the Kinsey scale today is not necessarily where you will be in a decade, or where you were a decade ago. Per research, women are more likely to change their sexual orientation over time than men, but a lot of us have the capacity to have our head turned by someone we never expected. I'm a sex therapist with short hair who teaches yoga. It's a common assumption that my partner would be a woman. My response when people ask is, "Nope, but the day ain't over." Glennon Doyle and Elizabeth Gilbert are both women who have written extensively about their lives and their relationships with their then-husbands, love warrior and committed, respectively. Both are great. Both later made news for making their current partnerships with women public and their declarations that it wasn't about the label, it was just their person. Their stories are ones I associate with home that, despite pushback, we are moving in the right direction of affirming the individual experiences of others, and that more and more people feel safe to publicly proclaim their experience. Orientation is not the same thing as gender, but it is informed by gender. Since the T, trans, and Q, queer, are lumped in with the L, lesbian, G, gay, and B, bisexual, there is still confusion in some circles about the overlap. Some super basic definition 101 that comes from the clinical training materials I use on the regular. Gender identity. Who you know yourself to be. You are assigned a sex at birth that may or may not reflect your actual gender. There's a ton of brain research about how our brain maps our gender and why it is sometimes different from our biological makeup. That's a whole separate conversation that belongs in its own book, though it remains important for me to say that whatever your gender identity, it's valid and true. You are exactly who you are supposed to be, and I'm really glad you share the planet with me. Sexual orientation. Who you are oriented toward in terms of romantic and sexual attraction. This is not the same thing as sexual preference. Preference is what you like to do in bed. Orientation is who you like to do it with. And once again, because I have a sneaking suspicion that someone listening to this really needs the reminder that your sexual orientation is a vital part of who you are. You are not broken, you don't need correction, and I'm really glad you share the planet with me. Gender is not sexual orientation, though your gender identity may direct the label of your sexual orientation. If, for example, you are a trans woman and you are attracted to men, you are a straight woman. If you had been attracted to men pre-transition, you may have been labeled as, or identified as, a gay man during that period of time. If you are in a partnership with someone who is transitioning or has transitioned from the gender identity you initially understood them to have, this may or may not change your perception of your sexual orientation. It may feel more fluid at this point, or it may simply be that your orientation hasn't changed, but you continue to be in love with the person that you fell in love with because their fundamental selfhood has not changed. And if you don't have a binary gender identity, that is, not male or female, more on this in a bit, then how you describe your attraction alignment can get even more complicated. If you're non-binary or agender and you like women, does that make you straight or a lesbian? Neither, right? We don't have great language for these cases, so I'm saying genderqueer and I date women is a mouthful, but might be the most accurate statement. This information is presented to provide support for your internal process. If your identity isn't easily explained or understood by others, the reality is you don't owe an explanation to anyone who is not living in your relationship at this moment. Fuck 'em if they don't get it. A legit case for polysexuality. Monosexuality means you have one category of attraction. You are either hetero or homosexual. Monosexism is the presumption that that's how all of us roll, when clearly it ain't. In fact, when you look at the LGBT stats, there are far more bi or pan, etc. people than there are gay or lesbian people. The reason that it's important to talk about is that individuals who are non-mono, bi or pan, etc., face greater discrimination than their gay and lesbian counterparts in medical care, mental health care, and employment. Bi women are twice as likely to be assaulted as other women, and bi men also have an increased risk. Polysexuality is its own complete identity, wherever you fall within the polysexual spectrum. It isn't early exploration or hesitation before coming out fully. It's not just a porn trope. There are millions of people who experience an array of sexual attraction that doesn't confine itself to a singular gender identity. You'll notice I'm using polysexual as an umbrella term. It used to be the only polysexual label was bisexual, and why toothbrush guy's scale is now pretty outdated. There are plenty of people who find that bisexual doesn't fit their sexual orientation, and the term pansexual has gained more attention in the process. And also thanks to Deadpool. Bisexual implies a binary attraction, at least in definition. Individuals who embrace pansexual as their identity generally express that they can experience attraction to individuals with a wide variety of gender identities, not just men or women. Though it should not be left unsaid that plenty of people who still embrace the term bi also express attraction across the gender spectrum, I found it tends to be more a generational term than anything else. People of my generation, Xers, and older, boomers, are more likely to use the term bisexual without necessarily differentiating it from pansexual definitionally. Other terms may include queer, which is an umbrella term for many people who identify as outside the norm, sapiosexual, attracted to Homo sapiens in many shapes and forms, or humisexual, I am attracted to humans, but of course not many, Morrissey. There is a lot of overlap in these identities. Much has been said about trying to parse out bisexuality in relation to pansexuality, for example. In theory, individuals who are bisexual are attracted to more than one gender, while individuals who are pansexual are open to relationships with anyone, no matter where they exist on the gender spectrum, if they have a gender identity at all. Of course, it doesn't quite work that way in practice, and people often have to choose the term that resonates best with their experience. For those of us who were older, bisexual was the only other category available, so we made it fit. Just because you're not monosexual doesn't mean you were open to getting busy with literally everyone, though no shade thrown from me if you are. Just like Morrissey, we all have certain types of people we gravitate toward. Sometimes we just gotta smell right to each other, you know? Asexuality. So we got all the fluid polysexual info down. But ha, we ain't done yet. Guess what? Even with all those loosey-goosey categories, we still have a group of people who will step up and say, hell nah, to all of them. All the asexuals quietly minding their business, preferring chocolate cake to sex, are now thinking, oh shit, she's bringing us into the equation? Yes, my ace buddies, you deserve a place in the conversation too. So let's tackle some ace fundamentals. What does it mean to be asexual? Asexuality is a sexual orientation characterized by a persistent lack of sexual attraction toward any gender. Asexuality Archive. Asexuality is sort of the forgotten orientation. It's been referred to as the third orientation in a lot of literature, but of course that presumes that the other two are gay or straight. According to a 2004 study, at least 1% of people qualify for this orientation, though the researcher notes that if you aren't interested in sex, you probably aren't interested in surveys about sex, so it might be higher. Even before that, Kinsey had a category X in his scale research. About 1.5% of his respondents weren't interested in sex with anyone, therefore didn't fit on the scale. So asexual, ace identity, isn't a newfangled thing that kids these days invented on Tumblr.